petty squabbles and tense silences becomes a collection of beautiful panoramas, perfect dinners, and smiling faces. 99% of what we experience never becomes part of the story of the self. It is particularly noteworthy that our fantasy self tends to be very visual, whereas our actual experiences are corporeal. In the fantasy, you observe a scene in your mind's eye or on the computer screen. You see yourself standing on a tropical beach, the blue sea behind you, a big smile on your face, one hand holding a cocktail, the other arm around your lover's waist. Paradise. What the picture does not show is the annoying fly that bites your leg, the cramping in your stomach from eating fish that had gone slightly off, the tension in your jaw as you fake a big smile, and the ugly fight the happy couple had 5 minutes ago. If we could only feel what the people in the photos felt while taking them. If you really want to understand yourself, you should not identify with your Facebook account or with the inner story of the self. Instead, you should observe the actual flow of body and mind. You will see thoughts, emotions, and desires appear and disappear without much reason and without any command from you, just as different winds blow from this or that direction and mess up your hair. And just as you are not the winds, so also you are not the jumble of thoughts, emotions, and desires you experience, and you are certainly not the sanitized story you tell about them with hindsight. You experience all of them, but you don't control them, you don't own them, and you are not them. People ask, "Who am I?" and expect to be told a story. The first thing you need to know about yourself is that you are not a story. No story. Liberalism took a radical step in denying all cosmic dramas, but then it recreated the drama within the human being. The universe has no plot, so it is up to us humans to create a plot, and this is our vocation and the meaning of our life. Thousands of years before our liberal age, ancient Buddhism went further by denying not just all cosmic dramas, but even the inner drama of human creation. The universe has no meaning, it claimed, and human feelings, too, carry no meaning. They are just ephemeral vibrations, appearing and disappearing for no particular purpose. That's the truth. Get over it. As noted earlier, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad tells us, "The head of the sacrificial horse is the dawn, its eye the sun, its members the seasons, its joints the months and fortnights, its feet the days and nights, its bones the stars, and its flesh the clouds." In contrast, the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, a key Buddhist text, explains that when a human meditates, he or she observes the body carefully, noting, "In this body there are hairs of the head, hairs of the skin, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, marrow, kidney, heart, saliva, nasal mucus, synovial fluid, and urine. Thus he dwells, observing body. Now his understanding is established. This is body. The hairs, bones, or urine stand for nothing else. They are just what they are." In passage after passage, the text goes on to explain that no matter what the mediator observes in the body or in the mind, he or she just understands it as it is. When the mediator breathes, breathing in a deep breath, he understands properly, "I am breathing in a deep breath." Breathing in a shallow breath, he understands properly, "I am breathing in a shallow breath." The long breath does not represent the seasons, and the short breath does not represent the days. They are just vibrations in the body. The Buddha taught that the three basic realities of the universe are that everything is constantly changing, nothing has any enduring essence, and nothing is completely satisfying. You can explore the furthest reaches of the galaxy, of your body, or of your mind, but you will never encounter something that does not change, that has an eternal essence, and that completely satisfies you. Suffering emerges because people fail to appreciate this. They believe that there is some eternal essence somewhere, and if only they can find it and connect to it, they will be completely satisfied. This eternal essence is sometimes called God, sometimes the nation, sometimes the soul, sometimes the authentic self, and sometimes true love. And the more people are attached to it, the more disappointed and miserable they become when they fail to find it. Worse yet, the greater the attachment, the greater the hatred such people develop toward any person, group, or institution that seems to stand between them and their cherished goal. According to the Buddha, then, life has no meaning, and people don't need to create any meaning. They just need to realize that there is no meaning, and therefore be liberated from the suffering caused by our attachments and our identification with empty phenomena. "What should I do?" ask people, and the Buddha advises, "Do nothing. Absolutely nothing." The whole problem is that we constantly do something. Not necessarily on the physical level, we can sit immobile for hours with closed eyes. Yet on the mental level, we are extremely busy creating stories and identities, fighting battles and winning victories. To really do nothing means that the mind also does nothing and creates nothing. Unfortunately, this too very easily turns into a heroic epic. Even as you sit with closed eyes and observe the breath coming in and out of the nostrils, you might well start constructing stories about it. "My breath is a bit forced, and if I breathe more calmly, I will become healthier." Or, "If I just keep observing my breath and do nothing, I will become enlightened and be the wisest and happiest person in the world." Then the epic starts expanding, and people embark on a quest not just to liberate themselves from their own attachments, but also to convince others to do so. Having accepted that life has no meaning, I find meaning in explaining this truth to others, arguing with the unbelievers, giving lectures to the skeptics, donating money to build monasteries, and so on. No story can all too easily become just another story. The history of Buddhism provides a thousand examples of how people who believe in the transience and emptiness of all phenomena and in the importance of having no attachments can squabble and fight over the government of a country, the possession of a building, or even the meaning of a word. Fighting other people because you believe in the glory of an eternal God is unfortunate, but understandable. Fighting other people because you believe in the emptiness of all phenomena is truly bizarre, but so very human. In the 18th century, the royal dynasties of both Burma and neighboring Siam prided themselves on their devotion to the Buddha and gained legitimacy by protecting the Buddhist faith. The kings endowed monasteries, built pagodas, and listened every week to learned monks who preached eloquent sermons on the five basic moral commitments of every human being: to abstain from killing, stealing, sexual abuse, deception, and intoxication. The two kingdoms nevertheless fought each other relentlessly. On April 7, 1767, the army of the Burmese king, Sinbushin, stormed the capital of Siam after a long siege. The victorious troops killed, looted, raped, and probably also got intoxicated here and there. They then burned down much of the city, with its palaces, monasteries, and pagodas, and carried home thousands of slaves and cartloads of gold and jewels. King Sinbushin did not take his Buddhism lightly. 7 years after his great victory, the king made a royal progression down the great Irrawaddy River, worshipping at the important pagodas on the way, and asking Buddha to bless his armies with more victories. When Sinbushin reached Rangoon, he rebuilt and expanded the most sacred structure in all of Burma, the Shwedagon Pagoda. He then gilded the enlarged edifice with his own weight in gold, erected a gold spire on top of the pagoda, and studded it with precious gems, perhaps looted from Siam. He also used the occasion to execute the captive king of Pegu, his brother, and his son. In 1930s Japan, people even found imaginative ways to combine Buddhist doctrines with nationalism, militarism, and fascism. Radical Buddhist thinkers such as Nisho Inoue, Iki Kita, and Tanaka Chigaku argued that in order to dissolve one's egoistic attachments, people should completely give themselves up to the emperor, excise all personal thinking, and observe total loyalty to the nation. Various ultra-nationalist organizations were inspired by such ideas, including a fanatical military group that sought to overthrow Japan's conservative political system by a campaign of assassination. They murdered the former finance minister, the director general of the Mitsui Corporation, and eventually the prime minister, Inukai Tsuyoshi. They thereby speeded up the transformation of Japan into a military dictatorship. When the military then embarked on war, Buddhist priests and Zen meditation masters preached selfless obedience to state authority and recommended self-sacrifice for the war effort. In contrast, Buddhist teachings on compassion and non-violence were somehow forgotten and had no perceptible influence on the behavior of Japanese troops in Nanjing, Manila, or Seoul. Today, the human rights record of Buddhist Myanmar is among the worst in the world, and a Buddhist monk, Ashin Wiratu, leads the anti-Muslim movement in the country. He claims that he only wants to protect Myanmar and Buddhism against Muslim jihadi conspiracies, but his sermons and articles are so inflammatory that in February 2018, Facebook removed his page, citing the company's prohibition on hate speech. During a 2017 interview with The Guardian, the monk preached compassion for a passing mosquito, but when confronted with allegations that Muslim women have been raped by the Myanmar military, he laughed and said, "Impossible. Their bodies are too disgusting." There is very little chance that world peace and global harmony will arrive once 7 billion human beings start meditating regularly. Observing the truth about yourself is just so difficult. Even if you somehow manage to get most humans to try it, many of us will quickly distort the truth we encounter into some story with heroes, villains, and enemies, and in that story, find really good excuses to go to war. The test of reality. Even though all these big stories are fictions generated by our own minds, there is no reason for despair. Reality still exists. You cannot play a part in any make-believe drama, but why would you want to do that in the first place? The big question facing humans isn't, what is the meaning of life, but rather, how do we stop suffering? When you give up all the fictional stories, you can observe reality with far greater clarity than before, and if you really know the truth about yourself and about the world, nothing can make you miserable. But that is, of course, much easier said than done. We humans have conquered the world thanks to our ability to create and believe fictional stories. We are therefore particularly bad at knowing the difference between fiction and reality. Overlooking this difference has been a matter of survival for us. If you nevertheless want to know the difference, the place to start is with suffering. Because, as noted earlier, the realest thing in the world is suffering. When you are confronted by some great story and you wish to know whether it is real or imaginary, one of the key questions to ask is whether the central hero of the story can suffer. For example, if somebody tells you the story of the Polish nation, take a moment to reflect on whether Poland can suffer. Adam Mickiewicz, the great romantic poet and the father of modern Polish nationalism, famously called Poland the Christ of Nations. Writing in 1832, decades after Poland was partitioned between Russia, Prussia, and Austria, and shortly after the Polish uprising of 1830 was brutally crushed by the Russians, Mickiewicz explained that the horrendous suffering of Poland was a sacrifice on behalf of the whole of humanity, comparable to the sacrifice of Christ, and that just like Christ, Poland would rise from the dead. In a famous passage, Mickiewicz wrote, "Poland said to the people of Europe, 'Whosoever will come to me shall be free and equal, for I am freedom.' But the kings, when they heard it, were frightened in their hearts, and they crucified the Polish nation and laid it in its grave, crying out, 'We have slain and buried freedom.' But they cried out foolishly, for the Polish nation did not die. On the third day, the soul shall return to the body, and the nation shall arise and free all the peoples of Europe from slavery." Can a nation really suffer? Has a nation eyes, hands, senses, affections, and passions? If you prick it, can it bleed? Obviously not. If it is defeated in war, loses a province, or even forfeits its independence, it still cannot experience pain, sadness, or any other kind of misery, for it has no body, no mind, and no feelings whatsoever. In truth, it is just a metaphor. Only in the imagination of certain humans is Poland a real entity capable of suffering. Poland endures because these humans lend it their bodies, not just by serving as soldiers in the Polish army, but by incarnating in flesh the joys and sorrows of the nation. When, in May 1831, news reached Warsaw of the Polish defeat at the Battle of Ostrołęka, human stomachs twisted in distress, human chests heaved with pain, human eyes filled with tears. All that does not justify the Russian invasion, of course, nor does it undermine the right of Poles to establish an independent country and decide on their own laws and customs. Yet it does mean that, ultimately, reality cannot be the story of the Polish nation, for the very existence of Poland depends on images in human minds. In contrast, consider the fate of a Warsaw woman who was robbed and raped by the invading Russian troops. Unlike the metaphorical suffering of the Polish nation, the suffering of that woman was very real. It may well have been caused by human beliefs in various fictions, such as Russian nationalism, Orthodox Christianity, and macho heroism, all of which inspired many of the Russian statesmen and soldiers. However, the resulting suffering was still 100% real. Whenever politicians start talking in mystical terms, beware. They might be trying to disguise and excuse real suffering by wrapping it up in big, incomprehensible words. Be particularly careful about the following four words: sacrifice, eternity, purity, redemption. If you hear any of these four, sound the alarm. And if you happen to live in a country whose leader routinely says things like, "Their sacrifice will redeem the purity of our eternal nation," know that you are in deep trouble. To preserve your sanity, always try to translate such hogwash into real terms. A soldier crying out in agony, a woman beaten and brutalized, a child shaking in fear. So, if you want to know the truth about the universe, about the meaning of life, and about your own identity, the best place to start is by observing suffering and exploring what it is. The answer isn't a story. 21. Meditation. Just observe. Now that I have criticized so many stories, religions, and ideologies, it is only fair that I put myself in the firing line too, and explain how somebody so skeptical can still manage to wake up cheerful in the morning. I hesitate to do so, partly for fear of self-indulgence, and partly because I don't want to give the wrong impression that what works for me will work for everybody. I am very aware that the quirks of my genes, neurons, personal history, and dharma are not shared by everyone. But readers should probably know which hues color the glasses through which I see the world, thereby distorting my vision and my writing. As a teenager, I was restless and troubled. The world made no sense to me, and I got no answers to the big questions I had about life. In particular, I didn't understand why there was so much suffering in the world and in my own life, and what could be done about it. All I got from the people around me and from the books I read were elaborate fictions, religious myths about gods and heavens, nationalist myths about the motherland and its historical mission, romantic myths about love and adventure, or capitalist myths about economic growth and how buying and consuming stuff would make me happy. I had enough sense to realize that these were probably all fictions, but I had no idea how to find truth. When I began studying at university, I thought it would be the ideal place to find answers, but I was disappointed. The academic world provided me with powerful tools with which to deconstruct all the myths humans ever created, but it didn't offer satisfying answers to the big questions of life. On the contrary, it encouraged me to focus on narrower and narrower questions. I eventually found myself writing a doctorate at the University of Oxford about the autobiographical texts of medieval soldiers. As a side hobby, I read a lot of books about philosophy and had lots of philosophical debates, but though this provided endless intellectual entertainment, it hardly provided real insight. I felt extremely frustrated. Eventually, my good friend Ron suggested that I try putting aside all the books and intellectual discussions for a few days and take a Vipassana meditation course. Vipassana means introspection in the Pali language of ancient India. I thought it was some New Age mumbo-jumbo, and since I had no interest in hearing yet another mythology, I declined to go. But after a year of patient nudging, in April 2000, he convinced me to go to a 10-day Vipassana retreat. Before this, I knew very little about meditation and presumed it involved all kinds of complicated mystical theories. I was therefore amazed by how practical the teaching turned out to be. The teacher at the course, S.N. Goenka, instructed the students to sit with crossed legs and closed eyes, and to focus all their attention on the breath coming in and out of their nostrils. "Don't do anything," he kept saying. "Don't try to control the breath or to breathe in any particular way. Just observe the reality of the present moment, whatever it may be. When the breath comes in, you are just aware. Now the breath is coming in. When the breath goes out, you are just aware. Now the breath is going out. And when you lose your focus and your mind starts wandering in memories and fantasies, just remain aware. Now my mind has wandered away from the breath." It was the most important thing anybody had ever told me. When people ask the big questions of life, they usually have absolutely no interest in knowing when their breath is coming into their nostrils and when it is going out. Rather, they want to know things like what happens after you die. Yet the real enigma of life is not what happens after you die, but what happens before you die. If you want to understand death, you need to understand life. People ask, "When I die, will I just vanish completely? Will I go to heaven? Will I be reborn in a new body?" These questions are based on the assumption that there is an I that endures from birth to death. And the question is, what will happen to this I at death? But what is there that endures from birth to death? The body keeps changing every moment. The brain keeps changing every moment. The mind keeps changing every moment. The more closely you observe yourself, the more obvious it becomes that nothing endures, even from one moment to the next. So what holds together an entire life? If you don't know the answer to that question, you don't understand life, and you certainly have no chance of understanding death. If and when you ever discover what holds life together, the answer to the big question of death will also become apparent. People say, "The soul endures from birth to death, and thereby holds life together." But that is just a story. Have you ever observed a soul? You can explore this at any moment, not just at the moment of death. If you can understand what happens to you as one moment ends and another moment begins, you will also understand what will happen to you at the moment of death. If you can really observe yourself for the duration of a single breath, you will understand it all. The first thing I learned by observing my breath was that notwithstanding all the books I had read and all the classes I had attended at university, I knew almost nothing about my mind, and I had very little control over it. Despite my best efforts, I couldn't observe the reality of my breath coming in and out of my nostrils for more than 10 seconds before my mind wandered away. For years, I had lived under the impression that I was the master of my life, the CEO of my own personal brand. But a few hours of meditation were enough to show me that I had hardly any control over myself. I was not the CEO. I was barely the gatekeeper. I was asked to stand at the gateway of my body, the nostrils, and just observe whatever comes in or goes out. Yet, after a few moments, I lost my focus and abandoned my post. It was an eye-opening experience. As the course progressed, students were taught to observe not just their breath, but sensations throughout their body. Not special sensations of bliss and ecstasy, but rather the most mundane and ordinary sensations, heat, pressure, pain, and so on. The technique of Vipassana is based on the insight that the flow of mind is closely interlinked with sensations of the body. Between me and the world, there are always bodily sensations. I never react to events in the outside world. I always react to the sensations in my own body. When the sensation is unpleasant, I react with aversion. When the sensation is pleasant, I react with a craving for more. Even when we think we react to what another person has done, to President Trump's latest tweet, or to a distant childhood memory, the truth is that we always react to our immediate bodily sensations. If we are outraged that somebody insulted our nation or our God, what makes the insult unbearable is the burning sensation in the pit of our stomach and the band of pain that grips our heart. Our nation feels nothing, but our body really hurts. You want to know what anger is? Well, just observe the sensations that arise and pass through your body while you are angry. I was 24 years old when I went to this retreat and had experienced anger probably 10,000 times. Yet I had never bothered to observe how anger actually feels. Whenever I had been angry, I had focused on the object of my anger, something somebody did or said, rather than on the sensory reality of the anger. I think I learned more about myself and about humans in general by observing my sensations for those 10 days than I had learned in my whole life up to that point. And to do so, I didn't have to accept any story, theory, or mythology. I just had to observe reality as it is. The most important thing I realized was that the deepest source of my suffering is in the patterns of my own mind. When I want something and it doesn't happen, my mind reacts by generating suffering. Suffering is not an objective condition in the outside world. It is a mental reaction generated by my own mind. Learning this is the first step toward ceasing to generate more suffering. Since that first course in 2000, I began meditating for 2 hours every day, and each year I take a long meditation retreat of a month or two. It is not an escape from reality. It is getting in touch with reality. For at least 2 hours a day, I actually observe reality as it is, while for the other 22 hours, I get overwhelmed by emails and tweets and cute puppy videos. Without the focus and clarity provided by this practice, I could not have written Sapiens or Homo Deus. At least for me, meditation never came into conflict with scientific research. Rather, it has been another valuable tool in the scientific toolkit, especially when trying to understand the human mind. Digging from both ends. Science finds it hard to decipher the mysteries of the mind, largely because we lack efficient tools. Many people, including many scientists, tend to confuse the mind with the brain, but they are really very different things. The brain is a material network of neurons, synapses, and biochemicals. The mind is a flow of subjective experiences, such as pain, pleasure, anger, and love. Biologists assume that the brain somehow produces the mind, and that biochemical reactions in billions of neurons somehow produce experiences, such as pain and love. However, so far we have absolutely no explanation for how the mind emerges from the brain. Why is it that when billions of neurons are firing electrical signals in a particular pattern, I feel pain, and when the neurons fire in a different pattern, I feel love? We haven't got a clue. Therefore, even if the mind indeed emerges from the brain, studying the mind is a different undertaking from studying the brain, at least for now. Brain research is progressing in leaps and bounds, thanks to the help of microscopes, brain scanners, and powerful computers. but we cannot see the mind in a microscope or brain scanner. These devices enable us to detect biochemical and electrical activities in the brain, but they do not give us any access to the subjective experiences associated with these activities. As of 2018, the only mind I can access directly is my own. If I want to know what other sentient beings are experiencing, I can do so only on the basis of second-hand accounts, which naturally suffer from numerous distortions and limitations. We could, no doubt, collect many second-hand accounts and use statistics to identify recurring patterns. Such methods have enabled psychologists and brain scientists not only to gain a much better understanding of the mind, but also to improve and even save the lives of millions. However, it is hard to go beyond a certain point using only second-hand reports. In science, when you investigate a particular phenomenon, it is best to observe it directly. Anthropologists, for example, make extensive use of secondary sources. But if you really want to understand Samoan culture, sooner or later you will have to pack your bags and visit Samoa. Of course, merely visiting isn't enough. A blog written by a backpacker traveling through Samoa would not be considered a scientific anthropological study, because most backpackers lack the necessary tools and training. Their observations are too random and biased. To become trustworthy anthropologists, we must learn how to observe human cultures in a methodical and objective manner, free from preconceptions and prejudices. That's what you study in the Department of Anthropology, and that's what enables anthropologists to play such a vital role in bridging gaps between different cultures. The scientific study of mind seldom follows this anthropological model. Whereas anthropologists often report their visits to distant islands and mysterious countries, scholars of consciousness rarely undertake such personal journeys to the realms of the mind. For the only mind I can directly observe is my own, and no matter how difficult it is to observe Samoan culture without bias and prejudice, it is even harder to observe my own mind objectively. After more than a century of hard work, anthropologists today have at their disposal powerful procedures for objective observation. In contrast, whereas mind scholars have developed many tools for collecting and analyzing second-hand accounts, when it comes to observing our own minds, we have barely scratched the surface. In the absence of modern methods for direct mind observation, we might try out some of the tools developed by pre-modern cultures. Several ancient cultures devoted a lot of attention to the study of the mind, and they relied not on collecting second-hand accounts, but on training people to observe their own minds systematically. The methods they developed are bunched together under the generic term meditation. Today, this term is often associated with religion and mysticism, but in principle, meditation is any method for the direct observation of one's own mind. Though many religions have made extensive use of various meditation techniques, this doesn't mean meditation is necessarily religious. Many religions have also made extensive use of books, yet that doesn't mean reading books is a religious practice. Over the millennia, humans have developed hundreds of meditation techniques, which differ in their principles and effectiveness. I have had personal experience with only one technique, Vipassana, so it is the only one about which I can talk with any authority. Like a number of other meditation techniques, Vipassana is said to have been discovered in ancient India by the Buddha. Over the centuries, numerous theories and stories have been ascribed to the Buddha, often without any supporting evidence. But you need not believe any of them in order to meditate. The teacher from whom I learned Vipassana, Goenka, was a very practical kind of guide. He repeatedly instructed students that when they observe the mind, they must put aside all second-hand descriptions, religious dogmas, and philosophical conjectures, focusing instead on their own experience and on whatever reality they actually encounter. Every day, numerous students would come to his room to seek guidance and ask questions. At the entrance to the room, a sign said, "Please avoid theoretical and philosophical discussions, and focus your questions on matters related to your actual practice." The actual practice is to observe body sensations and mental reactions to sensations in a methodical, continuous, and objective manner, thereby uncovering the basic patterns of the mind. People sometimes turn meditation into a pursuit of special experiences of bliss and ecstasy. Yet, in truth, consciousness is the greatest mystery in the universe, and mundane feelings of heat and itching are every bit as mysterious as feelings of rapture or cosmic oneness. Vipassana meditators are cautioned never to embark on a search for special experiences. Instead, they are encouraged to concentrate on understanding the reality of their mind, whatever this reality might be. In recent years, scholars of both mind and brain have shown increasing interest in such meditation techniques, but most researchers have so far used this tool only indirectly. The typical scientist doesn't actually practice meditation herself. Rather, she invites experienced meditators to her laboratory, covers their heads with electrodes, asks them to meditate, and observes the resulting brain activity. That can teach us many interesting things about the brain, but if the aim is to understand the mind, we are missing some of the most important insights. It's like someone who is trying to understand the structure of matter by observing a stone through a magnifying glass. You hand this person a microscope and say, "Try this. You will see much better." He takes the microscope, picks up his trusted magnifying glass, and carefully observes through the magnifying glass the matter from which the microscope is made. The point is that meditation is a tool for observing the mind directly. You miss most of its potential if, instead of meditating yourself, you monitor electrical activities in the brain of some other meditator. I am certainly not suggesting abandoning the present tools and practices of brain research. Meditation doesn't replace them, but it might complement them. It's a bit like when engineers excavate a tunnel through a huge mountain. Why dig from only one side? Better to dig simultaneously from both. If the brain and the mind are indeed one and the same, the two tunnels are bound to meet. And if the brain and the mind aren't the same, then it is all the more important to dig into the mind and not just into the brain. Some universities and laboratories have indeed begun using meditation as a research tool rather than as a mere object for brain studies. Yet this process is still in its infancy, partly because it requires an extraordinary investment on the part of the researchers. Serious meditation demands a tremendous amount of discipline. If you try to objectively observe your sensations, the first thing you'll notice is how wild and impatient the mind is, and how difficult it is to focus it even on a relatively distinct sensation such as breath. When a microscope goes out of focus, we just need to turn a small handle. If the handle is broken, we can call a technician to repair it. But when the mind loses focus, we cannot repair it so easily. It usually takes a lot of training to calm the mind and make it concentrate so it can start observing itself methodically and objectively. Perhaps in the future we will be able to pop a pill to achieve instant focus. Yet, since meditation aims to explore the mind rather than just focus it, such a shortcut might prove counterproductive. The pill might make us very alert and focused, but at the same time it might also prevent us from exploring the entire spectrum of the mind. After all, we can easily focus the mind today by watching a good thriller on TV. But the mind is so concentrated on the movie that it cannot observe its own dynamics. Yet even if we cannot rely on such technological gadgets, we shouldn't give up. We can be inspired by anthropologists, zoologists, and astronauts. Anthropologists and zoologists spend years on faraway islands, exposed to a plethora of ailments and dangers. Astronauts devote many years to difficult training regimes, preparing for their hazardous excursions to outer space. If we are willing to make such efforts in order to understand foreign cultures, unknown species, and distant planets, it might be worth working just as hard in order to understand our own minds. And we had better understand our minds before the algorithms make our minds up for us. Self-observation has never been easy, but it might get harder with time. As history unfolded, humans created more and more complex stories about themselves, which made it increasingly difficult to know who we really are. These stories were intended to unite large numbers of people, accumulate power, and preserve social harmony. They were vital for feeding billions of hungry people, and making sure those people didn't cut each other's throats. When people tried to observe themselves, what they usually discovered were these ready-made stories. An open-ended exploration was too dangerous. It threatened to undermine the social order. As technology improved, two things happened. First, as flint knives gradually evolved into nuclear missiles, destabilizing the social order became more dangerous. Second, as cave paintings gradually evolved into television broadcasts, it became easier to delude people. In the near future, algorithms might bring this process to completion, making it well-nigh impossible for people to observe the reality about themselves. It will be the algorithms that will decide for us who we are and what we should know about ourselves. For a few more years or decades, we still have a choice. If we make the effort, we can still investigate who we really are. But if we want to make use of this opportunity, we had better do it now. This is Derek Perkins. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of 21 Lessons for the 21st Century by Yuval Noah Harari. This program was produced by Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2018 by Yuval Noah Harari. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.